Welcome to One House. This is our seventh podcast, and today's episode we will entitle The President's Club. And it is because we have two very iconic people from the talent business. And I know they're looking at me now because I use the word iconic. We're off to a good start. But we have two icons in the talent business associated with restaurants in Canada. And we're going to talk a lot about talent management today. But before we do, we're going to introduce our guests. We have Scott Bellhouse today, who is president of Profile Hospitality, the premier restaurant recruiting company in Canada. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you for having me.
And we're at your office here in Toronto, your uptown office.
Yes, we are.
Thank you for hosting us. And Jan Vanderhoop is president of Fit First Technologies. And Jan, I have to say this as well. You're also a University of Guelph alum.
So I am.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And before we get into talking about talent management, I just want to point out publicly to our listenership that these gentlemen both do a lot of great work in the industry behind the scenes, and I want to take a minute to recognize them. Scott has been a big supporter at the University of Guelph as far as student bursaries and stepped up in his sponsoring our excerpt symposium this year, Scott, plant-based menus, which we'll be passing along more information to our listenership. So Scott has contributed a lot to not only the University of Guelph, but the industry. And Jan, the most active alum of all of our alums, I think you're at every event, career nights, sharing your tools with our students, guest lectures. You've been wonderful and contributed, added so much value to our student experience. So thank you, gentlemen. It really goes a long way to all our students.
It's always a pleasure to come home.
Yeah, and I think this is indicative that you're spending a rainy Saturday afternoon with me is also representative of your contribution to the industry. What we're going to do first, gentlemen, is we're going to have you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about something that your company is doing right now. So, Jan, why don't you go first and just give us an update on Fit First and where you are.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. So, I think I'm probably the poster child for twisted careers. I started out in the hotel business with Hilton International, and that's where you and I actually first met.
Yes, a long time ago.
And from there to packaged goods and with the PepsiCo organization, and then into retail with Office Depot, and started my career in ops, ended up in HR sort of by accident. That was supposed to be a six-month stop in the management training rotation, and ended up shaping the next 15 years. So since I left corporate, I've done a few things. I mean, when I left, I did what just about everybody does when they leave corporate, and that is to start consulting. And for me, it was sort of in the intersection between people and organizations and organizational systems. And then I, again, by coincidence, bumped into the fellow who is now my business partner and has been for a dozen years. We met through an Oakville Chamber of Commerce event. And this whole path that we've been on for the last dozen years really began over a beer as we were talking about what was going on
like
in our respective organizations.
Most good things do.
Most good things do.
Yeah.
And what we were remarking on was as we were observing our respective clients, what we noticed, and it didn't really matter what industry they were in. It could have been the hospitality industry, could have been retail, could have been had clients even in the insurance business, and what they found was they were hiring an awful lot of people, but a lot of those people weren't sticking. Mm-hmm. And as we started to peel it back, we realized a few things fairly quickly. One is when you consider the process that most organizations go through when they seek to fill a position, it begins with the resume. Mm-hmm. So the resume is the admission ticket in the door.
Yep.
And the organization will sift through the resumes using whatever Ouija or algorithms they've got at their disposal and make up rules. I mean, we all did it. I did it for years.
We
make up rules about who makes it into the A pile and who makes it into the B or C pile. And regardless of the piles, the reality when you look at the statistical research behind it is the factors that are in the resume are very weak predictors. So we tend to put an awful lot of weight on, education, mm-hmm. credentials, work history, the organizations that you've worked at before, you know, the whole pedigree thing. And what we lose sight of very quickly in our quest to validate the pedigree is that the pedigree is not all that important.
Right.
What's far more important is who the person is and how they fit and how they connect in the organization, how they sit in the context in which they're going to be doing the work. And as we continued to peel it back, we recognized that, again, we're not bright enough to do all the research, but we tripped across the research fairly easily. There's actually four critical aspects of fit. And first is fit with the manager, because that, for any of us, is the single most important relationship.
And I think the research bears out that's why most people leave a job, because the supervisor, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So it makes sense.
Well, I think it was Gallup that coined the phrase, you join the organization and you leave your manager.
Yeah, that's it.
And I know I did that more than once.
Absolutely.
The second is fit with the job. So, you know, what's the degree to which the job challenges me, intrigues me, draws from my strengths more than it asks me to draw from a non-strength? The third aspect of fit is, you know, the people I spend my day with. So, you know, if it's a heart of the house position, it would be fit with my coworkers primarily. If it's a customer facing or a guest facing position, it would be fit with the clientele.
Could be both.
And coworkers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then finally is fit with the organization, culture, values, mission, direction. You know, bottom line, is this a place I feel proud to tell my friends I come to work? And so all the research continued then and still does bear out the critical importance of getting the fit to line up. And yet, at the time when Tim and I met 12 years ago, there were no systems out there at the time that filtered people on the basis of fit first. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we started to do. We designed a system. I mean, it looks, you know, 12 years later in hindsight, it looks amateurish, but it was really doing a very good job. And we had clients who'd been using it for a year coming back and telling us all kinds of stories about how their business was different, how it was stronger, how it was performing better by virtue of the fact they had found a way to bring in people who were a closer fit with
right.
the organization.
And moving away from the intuition-based hiring to more evidence-based, obviously, scientific approach, would you say?
Absolutely scientific approach. Mm-hmm. And of course, the way we deliver that today is very different from the way we started out a dozen years ago, because technology's changed, science has changed. I mean, there's a whole lot more.
I'm amazed, actually, and you and I speak regularly, but I'm amazed how every time we meet, there's a new advancement. You're improving, you're evolving,
Great. So, you know, the old saying is hire slow and fire fast.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I always buy into the fire fast thing, but we are kind of the, you know, we help you hire slow in a fraction of the time.
Right. That's great. With better percentage success rate.
Right.
Very good. And we'll move on to Mr. Bellhouse. Scott, what's up with Profile and what are you doing these days?
I'll talk a little bit about kind of my history, if that makes sense.
It does.
I spent the better part of 20 years in operations and with a couple of really good companies. I started my leadership career with Earls, which is a fantastic company to start with. A great company when you're just getting out of school and want to get into a sense of how to run a business and how to treat people and all those types of things. Then left there and actually made my next move, which was really my last move into operations with a company called Oliver Bonacini.
I've heard of them.
Yes. And I was lucky enough to be hired by a gentleman by the name of Bruce McAdams.
Well, I know that guy, yeah.
Yeah. And so spent about 5 or 6 years there and made a quick stop with a hospitality recruitment firm based in Toronto called Lacour Wolfson. And then ultimately ended up back at Oliver Bonacini in an operations role when you made a move over to Guelph University as a professor.
To the dark side. I went to the dark side.
And so I came in and spent about 3 years in a multi-unit capacity with Oliver Bonacini in downtown Toronto. In 2011, I decided to, after many years, I decided I wanted to open my own business and see how entrepreneurial I really was. And started Profile Hospitality Group in 2011, and here we are in 2017.
It's gone so quickly.
Yeah, 7 years of, you know, as I'm sure Jan can attest to, it's it goes by really fast.
It
and
does.
Sometimes when you think you're, you know, 7, 8 years in, it feels like it's only the first 2 years.
Right.
And so, you know, I started on my own in 2011. Funny enough, working out of an office in my in-law's home to keep costs low and start on a basic thing. Yep. And here we are today with offices in British Columbia, Calgary, and downtown Toronto, where we're doing this podcast from. And we have soon to be 5 employees based in Toronto.
It's incredible.
1 in Alberta and 3 in British Columbia.
Wow. And you've placed... You place a lot of people. You've grown. You've expanded, but I bump into people all the time at restaurants, and they're like, "Yeah, Profile referred me here or got me at the job." So well done.
We met a bunch today.
Yeah, we did. We were able to thanks to Scott to get a tour of the new craft. Now is it called Craft?
Craft Beer Market.
Beer Market.
Yeah.
At Yonge and Adelaide. We had a great tour there. Our old friend Dave Barton showed us around. It looks like a great place, opening soon.
Yeah.
And yeah. All right. So thanks for the intro, gentlemen. We're going to, I'm going to really focus on your expertise and your perspective of being outside of the industry a little. And again, this is my opportunity to say I have people that are not in operations. They're not hiring. They're helping companies acquire talent in two very different ways, but two very important ways. So I want to read you something from Restaurants Canada labor shortage report that just came out, and it said, "Our recent restaurant outlook survey shows 31% of food service operators are experiencing skilled labor shortages." Now, I think that's maybe a little conservative, one third. But I think we have to take into context that this survey was done with members of Restaurants Canada, and people filling out surveys that are members are probably more on top of their human resource practices. So you might say 30, you know, one third to half of the restaurants in Canada would be my estimate. And the three of us at this table have a lot of experience, and Jan, I would say, you know, 30 years ago when I started, there was labor issues. Mm. 15 years ago when I started working with Scott, we worked together for 5 or 6 years. We had issues and there was peaks and valleys, and it's cyclical. But I'm at the point now where I'm feeling maybe this is a little different, that this is maybe something's changing. Maybe we're at a bit of I hate to say it, but a bit of a low point or a more challenging point. And I want you to give me your perspective of where you think we are. So... Jan, why don't I start with you and get your thinking?
My sense is the industry is a very different place than what it was when you and I joined. So I took my first summer job with Hilton in '79, and in my second summer I was working in what was then called the personnel department.
Right.
And as just a schlep, I mean, it was, and I can remember there were. Cards all over the place.
Typewriters.
Computers didn't exist.
No.
I mean, they weren't even in the cards yet. But it was a time when there was just a tremendous shortage of labor, even then. And there's a couple of things that come to mind for me right away, just as we launch into the conversation. One is, as a kid starting in the industry who knew nothing, I was lucky enough to join at a time when managers of people first, and then doers of tasks and things second. And, you know, even in Hilton in those days, managers were pretty heavily incented on their ability to promote, first of all, recognize,
right,
and then develop, and then promote, and ideally export talent out of their department into other departments. And I don't see that so much in the industry today.
Right.
You know, I think, you know, that this industry isn't a whole lot different from many others in the sense that, you know, The margins are razor thin. Layers and layers of management have been cut out of the system. Most managers are working managers.
It's short term now, very much short term.
Absolutely. Yeah. And managers are so busy looking after tasks and projects and things that are on their own plate to get done that we've starved them of the ability to pay attention to their people.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the very nature of that, what it's starved out of the system is the human connection, the human interaction. So work is transactional.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what was a tough industry in those days, I think, has gotten a whole lot harder to survive in
right.
for everyone.
It's interesting because that, you know, at that point, you know, I think we've moved into this point in time in the industry where we've accepted that the industry is a transitional job for people as well. We've mm-hmm. accepted that people will come in and out of the industry, and we've almost built that into our costing models and accepted it. And there are companies that focus on people, but I think they're less and less to build on your point. Scott, what is your thinking on where we are right now compared to maybe what you've seen in the past?
Well, I think I have a bit of a different perspective now. As a similar to Jan, I'm a supplier in a sense. I'm a vendor or supplier to the hospitality industry. I just supply people mm-hmm. as opposed to a commodity product. But having said that, I think that more and more, to both points that were made by you guys, were that people see often businesses to people as a commodity, just like wine or food, or it's so related to the bottom line that it's all been packed together. You buy food to sell, you buy alcohol or beverage to sell. Well, people have come so far into that category now that it's just another expense on a P&L statement.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I think in a sense, where in my business that I've seen, I started recruiting in 2007. And then I started my company in 2011. And what I've been able to see over that time, if we're talking about people and retention and people wanting to get in the industry, I remember back in 2007 when I worked at the first recruitment firm, the logic then was if someone didn't stay in a position in a leadership role in a restaurant or a hotel, and a lot of what we do is definitely food and beverage related because that's where the need is based on the hours.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that you didn't do is you didn't look at someone that really couldn't stay somewhere for 2 years.
If they were
2 years or less, they were considered a job jumper. Mm-hmm. Today, it's completely the other side. If someone's got 2 years or more,
they're staying.
They're loyal.
Right.
So, the days of what you said, Jan, where, you went in, if you look at a guy like myself, I spent 8 years with one company and almost 10 with another. Mm-hmm. And that a lot was the most of my industry experience. Now, mm-hmm. I was fortunate enough to move within those companies. But the average tenure of what my understanding, and I think it's from Restaurants Canada, is that the average tenure of a leader in a restaurant or hotel food and beverage operation is about 22 months.
Right.
And so if you think about that, that's astounding to me.
Yeah.
Well, it takes them 12 to get up to speed.
I was going to say, it takes our plan was always a year of learning and then a year of reinforcing, and then you'd move them up to another position after 2 years, but they're not even lasting 2 years now.
Well, I think the big part of that is that in these companies, what they're not, I don't know if they're refusing to do it or they just decided it wasn't important, is, and something that was done for me when I worked with UNB was done for me when I worked at Earls was, there was better communication because they had more time, whatever that looks like.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a career path laid out. And it wasn't a promise, but it was, if you do this, here's what the next 2 years looks like.
Right.
I talk to candidates every day, and people aren't hearing that from employers anymore. So if you feel your employer is not loyal to you, why would you be loyal to your employer?
Right. Is that something that they want? Sorry to interrupt, when you're placing people, they want to hear from an employer that they have a plan for me, and it's a formal, I'm going to do 6 months here. Are you saying that's what people want?
The biggest thing that people look at when you're going through and you're placing someone in a leadership salary role, the number one thing, and I don't know that this will ever completely change, but is obviously the compensation package.
First, yeah.
Yeah, because they have to live and pay their mortgage or their rent or things like that. But I think the second thing is, what does growth look like for me within this organization? Because I do believe that someone doesn't want to change a job every 2 years, because even if you do move from a manager title to a general manager restaurant, you still have to start over and prove yourself.
For sure.
So I think that's something that companies would be to be more aware of, is that why lose those people?
Well, and I think millennials are given a bad rap. Yes. Everybody's talking about these damn generations in the workplace, and how hard it is, and the millennials are disloyal and they're opportunistic, and that is all a bunch of hooey to me. I think honestly, if you sit down and talk to any one of them, they're not a whole lot different from us when we started. We were looking for a place where somebody notices us, gives enough of a damn to invest a little bit in us, to help show us the way, to help us through the mistakes that we make, helps us learn from those mistakes, and is willing to stretch and grow and challenge us.
Right.
The millennials are exactly like us.
So let me ask you this then, Jan, based on your HR experience, put on your HR hat for a second. How have HR departments and the way we managed people, are they fulfilling the participation they should? Are they checking the boxes and doing the things that they should? Are we a little off? Have we taken a step backward? Where are we with HR, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, it's a broad brush, so I have to be really careful. I mean, I think generally speaking, HR is much more process-focused today than it's ever been. A lot of it is about making sure that they tick the boxes and right. that they, they're making sure that the policies are all in place and, all of that's covered. If I had to really fault HR, broadly speaking, for any one thing, it would be for not understanding and not being involved enough in the day-to-day operation. Mm-hmm. But HR tends to stay in their office, in my opinion, and loses sight or maybe even never really fully understood how the business makes money.
Right.
And that problem is perpetuated by the HR Association, which, credentials people who've never worked outside of HR. And I think that's a dreadful mistake.
Now, there are companies that are decentralizing their HR and doing things where there's very few people in official HR positions. They let the operators do the hiring. Do you see that as a benefit, Scott? Is that, without naming the companies, do you think that is an approach that maybe is a little bit more progressive?
I would say, in my experience, the larger companies that we work with that are most effective and able to move the fastest and make good decisions, be proactive as opposed to reactive, which is funny. You would think it would be the larger organizations with resources. It's actually not.
Right.
It's often, I would say in my business that, and maybe it's the clients that I have, but 80% of the clients that I work with directly, I deal more with the heads of operations, whether it's a director, VP, or C-level person, than I do with someone in HR, right? And I find that ultimately, without making everybody in human resources that listens to this hate me,
right.
Is that ultimately that's the better way to go.
And that's it cuts out a person.
But you know what ultimately happens, Bruce, is that the HR person ends up having to filter it up anyway to
Absolutely.
The decision maker.
Right.
So to your point, you're cutting out a middle person.
Yeah.
And so I think that in that sense, the companies that are the most effective are the ones that have a smaller HR contingent when it comes to things around hiring, operations, and where the revenue stream comes from should ultimately be, HR should be a support to that. And in often cases, it's not.
You mentioned, and I want to touch on this retention, idea of retention and the cost of turnover, because we had a lively conversation at lunch over this. And the idea that, and all three of us agree, that the cost of turnover is huge. And we'd love to see a line on income statement that says turnover costs you this much. Why do we as operators, and I'll speak from my own personal experience, why don't we get that? Why don't we value that? We said maybe we're commoditizing people more than ever before. And Jan, you've been around. Why don't we get that? The cost, the financial ramifications of turnover.
Well, it's hard to measure. And there's direct costs and there's indirect costs. And the truth of the matter, I think, is even if someone were to sit down and do the paper exercise of what it costs us in terms of direct and indirect, the number they'd end up with is so terrifying that they'd either shred the piece of paper and pretend they'd never done the exercise,
right.
or they'd deny that it was actually possible.
Right.
Right? So they try to rationalize it away. Mm-hmm. But the cost is absolutely staggering, not just in terms of, advertising and, screening and interviewing and training and onboarding and all the rest of those things. But when you consider the friction in the system, if you do a mishire, you hire somebody into the team who's just not clicking with the rest of them. That results in all sorts of inefficiencies and waste and ill will.
Absolutely.
it results in customer problems, mm-hmm. you know, dissatisfaction. It results yep. in bad reputation. I mean, it damages yep. the brand in ways that are really hard to recover from.
And Scott, do you want to add to that about the economic cost of turnover?
Well, I think, you know, what's interesting is where, you know, I look at it more from a, I think, Jan, you might have a better perspective than me about the hourly people, right? But I think for me, I look at leadership. That's who I place. We place salaried positions.
Yeah.
Well, here's what I do know, Bruce, is that the smaller the company, and when I say smaller the company, I mean two restaurants or two hotels or larger.
Okay.
And those are usually the people that are using my services that can justify the expense. The smaller the company, the less turnover they have. Mm. And I think I'll tell you why I think so. Because I think the person that's making the decision around salaries and money that goes into developing their people, courses, wine course, whatever those things are, there's not eight layers between this person sitting in an office making a decision on what that budget is
right.
versus the person that's working a Saturday night on the floor in a restaurant.
Right.
So because if you look at some of these smaller companies, hence the company we went for a restaurant visit, the restaurant company is still small enough that the people at the top of the pile are still in those buildings, they're still visible, and it becomes real. It's these larger companies, again, without naming names, where it's so far away that mm-hmm. it's not felt.
They're removed from
yeah. it. Yeah. And I mean, look, I mean, the person that may run a big company in a C-level position maybe was a restaurant manager 25 years ago. You can't really remember what happened 25 years ago. And even if you do, it's not the same experience as it is today. I think a lot of it's driven around competition. Jan, you made a very good point about razor-thin margins. You know, I look at some of these West Coast-based restaurant concepts that are very successful. When I was working in the 90s in Vancouver, there were two casual dining restaurant companies, and they dominated that market. And not only did they not dominate the market, but they weren't even out in the East. And so they had such a large market share that they could afford to do so many other things. Well, that's kind of gone by the wayside a little bit. So I think in the turnover side, I think what's happened is there's too much of a distance between the person making the decision about what happens to the person down the line, and then there's just no contact between those people.
Right. And it is a relationship business.
Absolutely.
You know? And back to the comment about joining companies and leaving managers. I mean, people will leave managers not so much necessarily because of something that happened, but more often because there's an absence of a relationship.
Right.
Right. I mean, when you look at the whole engagement thing, I mean, this field of engagement has been researched and studied for
to death
a couple of decades yeah. now. But, you know, it's always in the eye of the beholder, and it's how does the individual feel? You know, so and the questions are really very basic. I mean, does my manager take the time to get to know me?
Right.
You know, does my manager, you know, are they curious? Do they watch me at work? Do they take the time to understand the things that I enjoy doing, the things that I'm really great at doing? And do they encourage me, find ways for me to do more of those things that I naturally do really well through my day? And do they find ways similarly to, you know, steer me so that I'm not drawing from my weakness most of the time? And so, you know, it does require the manager to be front and center and paying attention to their folks and actually engaging with them. You're not going to have an engaged workforce if you're not an engaging manager.
So we are having this conversation as three people in on the periphery of the industry, but three people that were involved firsthand in the industry. And something hasn't changed over this time, and it is the inability, and I don't know what the motivation is. I'm asking you or the reasoning, why the industry hasn't gotten together to have some sort of conversation about this topic. Because everyone I speak to in my position of an academic is looking for students. They're looking for bench strength. They're looking for recruiting. Everyone wants talent. Everyone's coming and saying, our biggest problem is bench strength. We need good people to manage. And we don't have it. Yet the industry hasn't gotten together, save Rosanna, Kyra, and Caustic Media 9 years ago when they had Labor 2020. Mm-hmm. And it took a publishing company to get the industry together, which was a very productive day. And it was the only time I can recall in my 30 years in the business that the industry got together to speak about labor and talent. And why what's holding us back from having this discussion, and why aren't we having the discussion as industry? Scott, what's your thinking?
I think it goes back to something Jan mentioned earlier, is that when it comes to people and turnover and people in general, it's not a black and white measurable issue.
Yeah.
And I think that people look at it and say, I've worked for people that I worked for in the past that actually said to me, turnover doesn't cost money. I've actually had people say that. And I could never wrap my head around that. And so I think the biggest reason is that Jan said, if you looked at turnover and measured the cost of it, I think that people wouldn't want to know the answer. And I think because it's people and it's not a controllable cost in a way, that I think it's something that no one's really tried hard to tackle, because it's almost impossible, or they think it's almost impossible to tackle.
Well, and let's face it, for the last couple of decades, the industry's been in a position of abundance. Somebody leaves, they're easy to replace, by and large.
But not anymore. Not anymore. With the demographic
that's
changes.
That's the part that's changing, right? And so... And it's not just this industry. We've seen it across the board, where there's no real pressure on fixing turnover other than this line that doesn't exist on the P&L because you can't measure it. And so human behavior has no incentive to change at that point. I think that's changing.
Right.
And I think that's healthy. And is there going to be pain? Yes, there's going to be pain. Is there, are some companies going to suffer? Absolutely. And I think it'll be the companies that that have the weaker managers, the poor leadership. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones, because talent is portable. Talent is going to move where the talent wants to go. And if you're not creating a place where people feel comfortable putting down roots, I think it's going to bite you.
It's interesting, your responses, and they make sense. And it reminds me of a conversation that Molly, our intern, who's back on a guest cameo today, filling in today for the podcast, and I were talking about with sustainability. With 20 years ago, people that were advocating more sustainable restaurants or whatever business would tell people they had to become more green for their grandkids' sake, and businesses would say, "Great, great, thank you very much. Go and have your walk down the road." And then, Bob Willard wrote a book called The Sustainability Advantage, which argued the business case for sustainability. And it was like, his argument was, if you want companies to be more sustainable, you have to show them the business case, that there's profit to be made, there's money to be made. And that is the way that the environmental movement especially has moved, towards showing businesses how there is a bottom line ramification. I think maybe there is a avenue for someone to write a book about the labor shortage and the cost of turnover in our business. Let's move on. The podcast is called One House for a reason. I like to bring, guests to the program to have an intellectual conversation about this concept of, and we're all looking.
You got the wrong guest.
Yeah.
Who's the intellect in the room? Yeah, me.
I can't spell it, so I don't. that I'm out by default. The one house concept is this idea that in restaurants we've created this, almost segregated ourselves into the front and the back. There's two different cultures in each side. There's some animosity that we know exists or can exist in some restaurants. There's different pay systems. And by doing this, the argument that I put forth, or that I'd like to create the discussion around, is there benefit to trying to eliminate that division and create what would look more like a one-house approach, one culture, one compensation model, where people maybe move freely between the two and you're not either a front of house or back of house? Because we know we all get slotted when we started. You're either in the front, in the back, and never the two shall cross. So, Jan, maybe I'll look to you first and say, what are your thoughts on this whole one house idea, and is there any validity to it, do you think?
I think there is. I think, whenever somebody is given ownership over an entire experience or over an entire process from beginning to end, their engagement is completely different, right? So, when you've got an employee who has the opportunity to create the meal and also serve it to the guest and interact with the guest, get feedback from the guest, that's immediate payback, right? And so it creates a different experience completely for your employees. I think it creates a completely different experience as well
for the guest.
And any time in my experience, and again, it really doesn't matter the industry or the workplace, where you've got an A team and a B team, it just, all it does is perpetuate dysfunction.
Absolutely. Now, it's interesting, and I think the idea of cooking the food and being the one who walks it out and talks and presents it to the guest is becoming more documented. There's more people doing it as well. And I find that is not as difficult in small independent restaurants as it is maybe, Scott, in the restaurants that you've worked in. So larger, fast casual. You're talking about, I can remember working at Bayview Village with you, and we'd do 1,000 guests in a day. So it might be harder to sort of make the obvious changes. What is your thinking of this idea of one house?
Do you think? I think for the sustainability of the industry long term, it's the only way to go. Now, I look at it, when I was listening to Jan speak, I thought, okay, why has it gotten to the point that it's gotten to? Mm-hmm. Like, what's led up to where we are now? Where, you know, I look at it more so from an hourly perspective than maybe, say, a salaried perspective. I think the salaries from where I sit and what I do is the salaries between, say, a manager, assistant manager, and a sous chef are pretty close. It's still a little less in the culinary side.
Right.
But it's not as big a gap as, say, a cook versus
a server.
Right, where it's huge.
Right.
But I think where the gap has started is if you look back to over the last 25 years, when someone's hiring a cook and when someone's hiring a server, they're looking for an extreme, completely different skill set. Even if you've never cooked or you've never served, you are looking for a completely different person, and they've always compensated based on that. I don't agree with it. I think it's wrong. And then people wonder why they can't find cooks. So that's what I know you and I have had many discussions about this in the past, is I think that you are hiring the job of a server, in my opinion, and this may get me into trouble later, is it's set up from the start to be a selfish job.
Right. It is, absolutely.
It's driven around money.
Yeah.
Right? And so when you're a cook, sometimes maybe it is a stopgap measure to something else. And you do it because maybe you don't have the confidence to go out and serve people and interact with people, which is a lot of the times is what happens.
True.
But when they get into leadership positions where they're leading other people, that requires a level
they have
of confidence.
To do that. They do.
But yeah. What happens in that situation is that then the dynamic changes. But it's when the initial hires happen at that sort of grassroots level or whatever you want to call it, or a frontline people,
right.
That's where the mistakes have been made. And I think when you're hiring someone to be a server or a bartender, the industry is so embedded the way it is in the culture that if you ask whether people would answer truthfully, why are they getting into it? And in the front, and a bartender, because they're choosing not only to do that job, but they're choosing the restaurant to go to based on where they think they can earn the most money.
Right.
And I'm not saying that's wrong.
No, it's just the way it is.
It's what we've set up.
We've set the system.
Absolutely. And the problem that in most cases is that the server that works at the family restaurant versus the server that works at the high-end restaurant, there's a huge gap.
Absolutely.
In terms of what they earn. But then you get into the family restaurant versus the higher-end restaurant in the culinary, the gap isn't that big.
No.
So this is where there's that huge issue. So to answer your question, the inequity has to be made up. I just think in a lot of cases, like around addressing the shortage, I don't think people know where to start, and
right.
I don't think they have the answer.
Let me ask you this. I had a very chef that I respect incredibly well, a great guy, and we were having this conversation. He said, Bruce, it's like if someone walks in the front door of a restaurant opening and they're in ripped jeans, and they have a day's growth, you send them to the chef. And if they're educated and have a degree and a press shirt, you send them to the front. And you don't have to hear them speak a word. We have these perceptions of who can work in the front and who can work in the back. You're shaking your head, Jan. Is there some truth to this?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it goes even deeper than that. I mean, it's, you know, the number of general managers that we've spoken to who really, frankly, are more interested in what they call the curb appeal,
right,
of the staff they hire for the front of the house than they are whether they're actually even a really good fit for the culture,
mm-hmm,
and for the brand.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And until we get our heads around that, I don't think anything is going to change. In fact, it's going to continue to get worse.
I have often found some of the most service-oriented people that I come across are in coffee shops, quick service restaurants where they're making minimum wage, and they have, and this is not always the case, but you find that they just have a desire to serve or please, and right, you just know they're working hard, and maybe because they are older or they don't fit a certain profile, they're working in a counter job versus working in a full service in a dining room, in a nice dining room, where I would argue they could do the work as well or better than some of our well-educated, pressed people.
Right. Well, to Scott's earlier point about selfishness,
mm-hmm,
you know, we've been fortunate enough to study the psychometric differences between servers who work in a tipping environment versus those who work in a non-tipping environment. And there are very clear distinctions between the two. And selfishness is really a good way to categorize it. I mean, the people who work in a team environment are there for the intrinsic value of the work,
right,
by and large. They're there to support one another. I mean, they bring to the table all the behaviors that we're looking for in people who are going to serve the guests who come into our establishment. But they're not attracted by the compensation.
No. And program. Jan, our research showed that tipping produces a self-motivation for a server versus an organizational motivation. So servers are, and we trained, Scott, you and I trained servers in our day, treat that section like it's your business. You know, so they go in and they take care of the customers in the three or four tables they have, and they don't really care about the people,
right,
in the other guests in the restaurant. They'll walk by hot food that needs to be walked. They'll won't go and bus another table in another section, God forbid. You know, we've experienced that. And some of the best service that I've seen have been in no tipping restaurants where servers I've interviewed have said, you know, I used to work at a company, and as a server in those companies, I had my own little section, my own guest, and that's who I cared about. And now customers, all customers in this restaurant are my customers, and my success is based on the restaurant's success. So there should be huge motivation for the operator to want that. What are you going to add?
Well, I think the challenge that I see, I was talking to a client of mine, I was talking to a candidate that was going to interview with one of my clients, and I had asked this person what they were able to do to save the business that they worked for money. And it was interesting because I think there's this, like when I talk to people about going from, say, tipping in this traditional sense that we see now versus no tipping, I think that most people that I talk to about it just say it's too much of a shock to the system. It's like going,
absolutely,
from $9 an hour to a $15 an hour minimum wage. People,
yep,
people choke on it.
Yep.
And I think that human nature is to find a happy medium. And okay, so if you're going to build to $15, build to $15. Or if you're going to build from tipping to no tipping, there has to be steps.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the crawl, walk, run theory.
For sure.
And so what I thought about this was this person that I spoke to said they had a rooftop patio in the summer. And they talked about the fact that it was obviously somewhat weather dependent. They had awnings and that sort of thing. But still, I mean, if it's going to rain, people are going to sit out there. So what they did up there to save labor, which saved the business money, was they had a kitchen upstairs. They had a rooftop patio. It's a beautiful restaurant downtown Vancouver. What they did was they pooled the tips
between inside and
patio. Everybody.
The whole thing.
The culinary people that serviced that, because,
yep,
it's like a 120-seat rooftop patio.
Yep.
So that was its own independent restaurant, and everybody pooled that money. So that if today Jan was going to get cut earlier than me, that it all evened out at the end of the day. And I thought, wow, they were able to save the business labor dollars because Jan knew that he was going to go home and not take a hit financially versus stay.
Absolutely.
You know.
And it's interesting you say that, Scott, because pooling's been around in restaurants for a long time. And the pooling restaurants that we have come across seem to have incredibly low turnover. People, and these are usually small independents, owner operator almost, and they've pooled for 20 years, and they have very, very little, if any, turnover because the system works. And I think there's an argument for it.
Well, and I think in those environments, like you're talking about, usually it's usually independent, higher end, small 50, 60 seat restaurants in most cases that
right.
I've seen. But they treat the business in a sense, and they treat their employees more like a family.
Yeah, right.
And so I think it goes back to that.
Like yep.
I think about when I worked at a resort, my first job was at a resort called Hockley Valley Resort. We used to work the dining room, and we pooled because a lot of people were coming in with meal tickets and things, and they'd already
right.
prepaid.
You yep.
So you pooled, and it was fair. It
yep.
was fair. So nobody could work harder. It just everybody had to pull their weight.
Yep.
And it was equal. You ran whatever food came up. And ultimately, the guests had a better experience, and everybody made money at the end of the day.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. And that's ultimately the sustainable business. Gentlemen, we are nearing the end, but I'm going to make you do one last thing for me, if you don't mind. And this, there was no prep for, so I'm really putting you on the spot. Not that we prepped a lot for this anyways. Jan, I'm going to look to you first. One bit of advice you'd give for a restaurant... and Scott, I'm going to ask you the same question, so I'm giving you a little bit of time to think about it. But one little bit of advice you would give a restaurant in their people management, hiring, selection, talent, other than your own company. You guys can't
yeah,
pitch
no.
your own company in for this. That's a given. So other than being a fit first user, what's something you'd advise people in a restaurant to do?
I guess for me, there's two things. One is hire for fit and train whatever. And the other is invest the time in getting to know your folks and stretching and growing and developing them.
Right.
Give them a reason to keep coming back.
Scott?
He stole my two ideas.
And he took two. I
yeah.
said one. And
yeah. Yeah. I would say one, and I've learned this through some of my own mistakes in my company, starting my company, is hire for fit and hire for culture, which ultimately are the same thing. So if I could add a second one too, is figure out how to get the most out of your people and figure out how they can get the most out of you.
So, right.
There you go.
Right. Two sides. The same coin. Gentlemen, this has been outstanding. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and bringing the discussion on One House and talent management in particular for you.